The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
And it is Brett King this week. Last week, JP stood in for me because I had delays with my flight getting back into the US from the Middle East and India. But I'm back in the studio in New York this week. We had a big storm last night here in New York. Trees blowing over, wires down, all that sort of stuff. So a bit of chaos on the streets this morning. But particularly outside of the city fared pretty well, better than it did in Superstorm Sammy. But everything's good. A few things for you guys to sort of kick things off. A couple of words quickly from our sponsors who support us. Quick shout out to Temenos, who's our primary sponsor for the show. But also, Finnovate's bringing a new conference, FinDevr, D-E-V-R. And this is focused on the technology side of fintech. They're kicking this off in New York City on March 29th. Go to newyork2016findevr.com. Use the code BREAKINGBANKSDEVAR20 for your 20% discount. And also don't miss out on NextBank USA in Silicon Valley on May 12th. JP, who is hosted for us last week, JP is going to be running that. Go to nextbankusa.com if you're interested in registering that. Lots of news at the moment, lots of interesting things happening. I have Cherry and Abraham joining us in a moment. We're going to talk about the Apple FBI issue in a moment. But before we get to that, I don't know whether you saw this, but did you see that Facebook is reading children's stories to their artificial intelligence? So their thesis is, and I buy into this, their thesis is that if you want robots and AIs that aren't going to take over the world, then they need to have empathy for humans. So you can check that out on Quartz, on QZ.com. There's a great story on that. So Facebook is actually reading classic children's books to AI to teach them more about humanity and what that's like. On other fronts, of course, you know the ongoing battle between the US and ISIL, or ISIS, Daesh, as they're otherwise known in respect to terrorist activities. But interesting thing is that both Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg have come out now and announced these initiatives to specifically weed out from the social media platforms people involved with ISIS. So what was ISIS' response? Well, ISIS came out issuing threats on Wednesday night against Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg directly, and advertising agencies associated with the Justice Department, saying they're going to hack these efforts to and sort of bring these platforms down if ISIL's not allowed to have their free speech on social media. So go figure. But the news that everyone's talking about, of course, is this Apple versus FBI fight. If you don't know about it, there is a case in the U.S. courts right now demanding that Apple unlocks an iPhone. In fact, it's not just one iPhone, it's 12 iPhones, but the one iPhone that's been focused on is an iPhone that was used by one of the perpetrators of the San Bernardino incident in California. And to talk about the implications of that possibly, we have Cherian Abraham on the show. Cherian's an industry commentator on Apple Pay and security on mobile. Cherian, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thanks, Brett. Thanks for having me.
So for those people that don't understand sort of the issues behind of this, what's so bad about unlocking this iPhone or opening up this back door into iOS so the FBI can get access to this phone?
Right. And I think it boils down to this, that you cannot necessarily just break into a single device. What FBI, what the Department of Justice is really asking Apple to do is to create custom firmware that they believe that their state is scope-bound to a specific device but can be used to unlock other devices. Obviously, will be done by Apple going forward, but essentially what they're asking for Apple to do is to create custom firmware and sign it with Apple's own encryption key so that to the device it looks as legitimate software that Apple has issued, but its only intent is to weaken the security on the device so that the device can be compromised and the data can be accessed. Apple's take on this whole deal is that amounts to an unreasonable amount of burden on Apple specifically, but also more broader than that, has huge implications when it comes to privacy and security. And the data that resides on a specific device that belongs to the consumer. So Apple looks at this as more along the lines as an overreach by the U.S. government than anything else.
In fact, I think Apple's playing it as a breach of what's the amendment that deals with seizures and search? They're playing that card at the moment, aren't they, I think?
I think we're going to start seeing Apple draw a line that states that code is free speech, right? So they're going to make the assertion that by asking Apple to change the code, to write code that essentially amounts to weakening the security on a specific device, and asking Apple to sign that custom firmware with encryption keys that only they have access to, that amounts to a violation of the First Amendment, that this is compelling Apple to essentially declare to the device and to its consumers that this is endorsed by Apple. And so that probably will be one of the directions that Apple can go in this prolonged fight, which I don't think we will see an end of just in the context of this particular case. I think we have larger questions that we need to ask. Absolutely, there is. Law enforcement has a pretty substantial challenge, right, with respect to technology and the evolution of technology and the evolution of encryption and the lack of access that they have into devices and the data that's stored in the devices. But creating backdoors, creating master keys, forcing Apple to weaken the security of iOS isn't exactly the way that you would go about it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Donald Trump weighed into this and said, come on, Apple, you know, you've got to do this, you know, terrorism, all that sort of stuff. But the reality is that the Department of Justice and FBI have put this request in for 12 different phones, only one of them which was used in a terrorist attack. So, it you know, the argument can't be made this is about terrorism, stopping terrorism. I think that's sort of a smokescreen. But you wrote a really good article on this the other day. Do you want to tell everyone where we can find your article on this? Because it had some great points in it, I thought.
Oh, thank you. It's actually on the American Banker site. It's gotten quite a bit of commentary as well as a lot of readership. So, yeah, I mean, just go over to American Banker and it's right there.
So, you know, there's obviously going to be increased scrutiny on this sort of data and information as we move more of ourselves and our lives onto this electronic medium. The ability to sort of get access to this information, governments are going to want to get access to monitor this, but it's a slippery slope, isn't it? I mean, once you start with this, where do you stop, right?
Absolutely. And why not treat it, so as you said, right, we have a very personal relationship with these devices, almost to the extent that we can actually look at data and what we do to these devices to be quite intimate and very similar to memories in the brain. So if we can call them very similar to, you know, memories in the brain, then as we expire, so shall the data on that device. That shouldn't, if I haven't consciously, you know, given that data to someone else, then once I expire, that data should pass away as well. It boils down to this, that in this age of where technology advances, you know, by leaps and bounds, right, every year, and the security of the security subsystems that are in that are part of these devices also needs to improve because fraudsters and malicious actors also evolve as technology evolves. We cannot put ceilings on. We cannot put a ceiling on the type of security that we have to instate in these devices to protect data. And protection of that data doesn't really care whether that is pictures, whether that's text messages, whether that's banking or commerce. They are all covered.
Just data.
Yeah, you can't cherry pick in terms of what you want to protect and what you cannot.
So, you know, the fact that the DOJ is asking Apple to do this currently means that Apple's encryption and their technology to secure these devices must pretty much be working. But, you know, how is it that, you know, it's not easy to unlock this phone? What have Apple done to prevent this sort of thing from happening easily?
Yeah, so for anybody who's interested in actually learning more about it, Apple continually updates its iOS security white paper, which is easily, you know, you can easily find on Apple's site. And it goes to a litany of steps that they have taken in terms of specifically ensuring that Apple is removed from all considerations with respect to the encryption and the security that is actually exists on the device, to the extent of it uses a combination of obviously the PIN code or the fingerprint that you use, but also there is a unique device ID that is written into the device at the time that the silicon is fabricated that exists on the device that cannot be queried by anybody on the device, no apps or even iOS for that matter. It exists within secure enclave, which is a protected area on the processor, and it never leaves. It can never be seen. It you know, sort of say that you can only sense what it does. You can only see the implications of that unique device ID. You can never actually see it or read it yourself. So by being able to couple that with the user-submitted PIN code or the fingerprint, Apple can ensure that every bit of data that resides on the device is encrypted by a combination of that, and that Apple cannot do anything in any case where that device needs to be, I mean, you know, the data needs to be decrypted.
So the user is in control. That's the main point, right?
Absolutely. And so Apple has to be very careful and very nuanced in terms of how do they balance their need for security, the consumer's need for security, and at the same time balance with convenience, right? So that's why any backups that we take onto iTunes, for that matter, it essentially uses the same the encryption measure. So it's not something that Apple can decrypt on behalf of a third party, except in the case of where that's actually backed up to an iCloud. So, and the intent there is that, you know, iCloud backups need to be decrypted by not just, you know, by when you have a subpoena or a law, you know, by a law enforcement entity. It's so that when you have a new device, you still have access to it so you can, you know, restore from that backup. So Apple has to have a very nuanced way in terms of how it balances convenience and security at the same time. But you can be sure that going forward, they're going to clamp down on that as well. That Apple, if not already, must be working on, a new security measure, a new encryption measure, right,
There's another issue here.
That away as well.
There's a couple of other issues here. One that's obvious, but if Apple does this for the U.S. government, they have to really do it for every other government as well. They're not owned by the U.S. government, so you know they're a global corporation with responsibilities to consumers all around the world. So they set a precedent here if they allow the U.S. government backdoor access. And what's to stop China or Iran asking for the same? You know, it's
absolutely. And that is the fear.
So, listen, we've just got a call to join us, Cherry, and I believe you know him, Dave Birch. Dave, welcome back to the show.
Hi, guys.
Thanks for joining us. Now, you just got off the plane from Barcelona where you were attending Mobile World Congress, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So, what were people saying at Mobile World Congress about this? Was it in the news? Were people talking about it?
No, people were talking about it. I mean, it wasn't talked about on stage much. And the truth is you can understand why, and I'm completely sympathetic to that point because, you know, you've got global telcos, global providers there. They don't all have their positions on this worked out. It's not that black and white. You know, it's pretty difficult to work out what the position should be. So you can understand why the big guys didn't want to get up and talk about it, especially, you know, in front of governments and the press and all that kind of thing. So that was understandable, I think. What people were saying, you know, in the corridors and around the coffee machine was pretty interesting, because on the one hand, people were saying, well, actually, you know, we admire Apple for taking a stand on this. A lot of us are fundamentally sympathetic to that privacy issue. I mean, there were a few cynical people saying, you know, this is the best advertising campaign that Apple could conceivably have ever imagined, you know, that they're going to sell a million trillion phones on the back of this. There were some people saying it was interesting that the keynote speaker, Mark Zuckerberg, said, so I can't remember the exact phrase, I'd have to Google it, but he said something along the lines of, we're very sympathetic with Apple, but didn't say, we'll encrypt Facebook Messenger and refuse to give the keys to anybody or anything like that. So there was a lot of talk, but I can understand why it's hard for people to come to positions on it, because it's really pretty nuanced. And as you've just pointed out, if a foreign government was to turn around and say, well, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to sell the phones in our country unless you provide that same access, because we have our own terrorist problem, right? You're going to get stuck. So when it comes to an absolutist position, I probably am on the Cook side of the line, in the sense that, you know, it's a very dangerous capability. And if anyone is going to have the ability to encrypt things, we should probably err on the side of allowing the public. But I'll give you a very simple example of why I might not want that. What happens if I go under a bus and there's important stuff on my phone that my wife needs and I forgot to back it up or didn't back it up? Or what if there's, you know, bank stuff that, you know, my phone gets smashed when I get executed by terrorists and my wife needs bank stuff back or the bank needs stuff back? So you know, it's just not that simple as saying the best solution is to lock everything up.
So this is the Zuckerberg quote. Thanks to Rachel for passing it over.
Thanks. I don't remember exactly what he said.
I don't think that requiring backdoors to encryption is either going to be an effective thing to increase security or is really the right thing to do. We're pretty sympathetic to Tim and Apple. So that sounds, it's pretty much what you said.
Right. And I think you can see why they have to be kind of a little bit nuanced in this language, because none of us want to be in a situation where, you know, we're undermining the legitimate rights of law enforcement. But, you know, these things have to be balanced out. And if it's a question of giving people who are dedicated to, you know, dedicated to the overthrow of everything we hold dear, an effective way of sneaking on my communications and your communications, and for that matter, the FBI's communications, that's a bit of a Pandora's box. I don't think it's much of a Donald Trump campaign slogan to say we believe that Al-Qaeda should be able to read the FBI's iPhones. I mean, that doesn't sound like an election-winning slogan, but then neither do any of his other ones. What am I to say?
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. There were 330 mass shootings in the United States last year, and here we are talking about San Bernardino, and we're trying to backdoor access a phone because we say that it could prevent terrorist attacks. We're not talking about the other 329 attacks in the US that were based on guns. No discussion about putting, you know, control.
No, I realize as a foreigner, it's very difficult to comment on this. I don't want to upset people in the US.
I live in the US, I still don't get it. So anyway,
but it does seem odd that you banned the phone and not the assault rifle.
So, Tyrion, just to sort of finish this off before we go to the break, because we do have to go to the break, you know, how do you think this is going to play out over the next couple of months?
So I don't think, so back to Dave's point where he was talking about how you know, that you need to be able to balance access to legitimate access to data. But I believe that can be done in a number of different ways. Apple certainly will stress the fact that, you know, this is not a debate with just around privacy, but it also, you know, just also about security. Looking back at even some of the things that Apple has done, you know, some very conscious decision on their part to separate in terms separate how they have chosen to build products and services compared to the likes of Google, where Siri is still very much tied down to Apple, doesn't aggregate information across consumers who use Siri. There are very conscious decisions that Apple has made that errs on the side of safety and privacy, right? I mean, so there is clearly a marketing strategy at the same time, but at the same time, it's a very privacy-friendly culture within Cupertino, and I think that's very conscious on their part.
Breaking news on this, because we've got to go to the break, but Apple just filed a motion opposing the court order to unlock the iPhone. They say it violates the First Amendment constitutional rights, and they've said, and Tim Cook quite rightly said, this is not about a single phone, this issue. And I think that's really what you guys are saying here, and I think we can agree at least on that. So, but Apple are going to make it tougher to hack their phones in the coming releases of their new operating systems and the phones. So this is going to be it's going to get harder and harder for organizations to backdoor these phones and get access to information. Cherian and Dave, thanks for joining us again on the show.
You're more than welcome. Talk to you again soon, mate. Bye. Thanks.
All right, so let's have a quick break, and we'll be back after the break with Jamie Punishall and the guys from TIAA.
What do you want your world to look like in 2030? This is Rachel Morrissey, the producer of Breaking Banks, and we are joining the UN Global Goals Initiative and participating in Radio Everyone this week from September 25th to October 2nd. Global Goals is a 15-year plan to address 17 specific goals to end poverty, fight inequality, and fix climate change. To find out more about Global Goals and Radio Everyone, go to www.globalgoals.org.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Moovin app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Moovin.com. That's Moovin.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks. I just had a call with Chris Skinner just before the show. It's very interesting. Chris is starting up I hope I'm not sort of breaking any secret news here, but Chris is setting up a venture fund focusing on blockchain. So great to see him working on this out of Europe. Blockchain's really hot right now, so it'd be interesting to see what those guys can do, sort of basically as the glue between banks who want to experiment with blockchain and getting access to fintechs who are sort of working on the cutting edge of that stuff. So you guys will know Chris because he's been host of the show. We'll get him on as soon as he's got some more news to talk about it. But before that, we just up now, we want to introduce Jamie Punishall. Jamie, have you been on the show before?
I don't think so. JP invited me a few months ago, and I couldn't pull it off. So I'm really happy I could join you today.
Yeah, that's great because, you know, of course, we've known each other for a long time. And you were one of the first guys to request a signed copy of my book, Bank 2.0. So that's why I remember that. And I remember I sent it to you and misspelled your name. So that's going back to about 2009.
Sounds about right.
Maybe, yeah. And then we, of course, met at South by Southwest that year in person. So was it that year or 2011 at South by? Might have been 20.
Probably more than once. Those were the good early heady days of the next generation of stuff. So
you're the head of digital marketing at TIAA, previously known as TIAA Cref. And you guys have you just rebranded. But why rebranding? And what is, you know, what's happening at TIAA? You know, what's this project you're working on?
Yeah. No. Thanks for that. You know, this is really the culmination of what's been really almost a 15-year transformation of the organization to move from just being a retirement services provider to not-for-profits, which we've been doing since 1918, and really become a diversified financial services firm. But, you know, as part of that, really then become a very customer-centric firm and really think about how we show up in the marketplace quite differently. You know, we haven't advertised really since 2008 or so, really post-crisis, and part of that was to really focus on building out a new customer experience. So the name is sort of the tip of the iceberg, but it really comes along with what's been a pretty profound transformation internally about how we think about experience, and the website is it's the most prominent example of trying to do something different.
Great. So when you say we have been around since 1918, you're not personally.
No. You might have been around since 1918. No, but a lot of people don't know. We were founded by Andrew Carnegie in 1918.
Oh, really?
To be really the retirement system for American institutions of higher education, and the mission expanded to include different forms of not-for-profits, and so we got a pretty long history. We invented the variable annuity in the mid 50s. That is actually what Kraft is.
That's nothing to be proud of, dude.
You know what? I variable annuities have a bad rap. We'll spend some time. I will re-educate you on the value of lifetime income and guaranteed income as a portion of your retirement savings.
Okay, so what's your new digitization strategy, and why TIAA? Why'd you drop Cref, and what's sort of what do you intend for this new organization to be? Who are you targeted at, and what's it going to do?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of layers to it. One, simplicity is a key. We know the importance of that, and the increasing importance of that in the not just in the digital world, but in the increasingly complex financial services world. And as ironic as what I'm about to say will be, just dropping the name Cref when you talk to customers, that just makes them feel like we're a simpler company to do business with right out the gate.
So TIAA is the Teachers Insurance and Annuity Association of America. Am I right?
That is the legal entity underneath that. And Cref obviously was the College Retirement Equities Fund. So we shortened the name, but that is, like I said, it's the tip of the iceberg. Along with that will come a national advertising campaign, actually the first one in the history of the company. That'll start on Monday morning, and that is really to raise awareness amongst our participants. We have about 4.5 million participants, amongst the wider 50 million person not-for-profit universe, and that's important, for folks to even know we exist as an option, and that we can do lots of new things like banking and wealth management. And we're a different kind of firm. We have a not-for-profit heritage. And in today's financial services firm, that really plays out quite uniquely, right? We run lots of our products at cost. We are, you know, are structured and to be, you know, conflict free, and we really think we're different, but not everybody. In fact, many people don't even know who we are. So that's really at the top of this, but we want to manifest that.
Let's focus on the changes you're making and why we should be excited about that. Because, you know, you're going from a very traditional organization started by one of the great industrialists, you know, so the, you know, the Elon Musk of 1918, you know, and, you know, you're now saying you're making a pitch for millennials and it's mobile based. But you know, how do you make an organization that is 100 years old, you know, that was founded around a very traditional financial services? How do you change that to be something that could be of interest to millennials on a mobile phone?
Yeah, so I think it's, you know, it's even bigger than that. But just start with, you know, the, let's face it, as an industry, we haven't done an awesome job of making things accessible, simple, understandable,
or
in a way people can interact with and engage. And that's a problem. We've got a retirement crisis in this country. We've got a financial services crisis in this country around people's savings. And so inertia is a problem. And if we're going to change that engagement, we really had to change things at a fundamental level. So if you hit the new website, you see, you know, as a, just as a representative example, you see a few things. One is, of course, it's fully responsive. You know, most of our emails opened up on a mobile device, so, you know, we start there. But you'll notice it's a very human design, and that's by design. And it, that comes out in very simple things like there's no stock photography on that website, which sounds like a simple thing, but everything on there is a real participant or a real employee or a real executive. And then you go through and we try to eliminate where possible almost all the jargon we can. So you see a ton less language, and I'll give you an example that, Brett, before we started the project, we had 37 different pages describing our life insurance products. In the new design, we have two. And that's pretty indicative of the level of sort of radical simplicity that sits underneath how we're designed, not just the web pages, but now that's cascading all the way through print collateral, you know, microsites, all kinds of other things.
So, so I get that. Tell me about how, you know, on a average daily basis, how someone might use mobile to leverage off this stuff.
Yeah, you know, again, so we think, you know, primary interaction model for us, really around somebody's retirement account first is going to be either them coming in, checking out their balances, maybe changing their contribution rates, or responding to one of our communication education programs, which is quite often happening via email. So they're going to come in and they're going to hit the website. When they come in, they're going to engage very differently in the site. One, because we talked about sort of the radical simplicity and the visual design, et cetera. But two, it's built on a lot of adult learning premises, which play themselves out even more in the mobile universe. A lot of, you know, we call it a mosaic design, little bite-sized bits of information, invite people to engage and unfold information more and more. So it fits more the modality of how you might consume information in a mobile universe, in a small screen universe, than you would necessarily in the desktop universe. And that's what the mobile universe is teaching us to do, right? Consume little bits more information and to get more. Revamp the login, really revamp the storefront of navigation and how that works. So it's really trying to compress the distance for folks. What's that?
I'm going to challenge you here, right? So I went to TIA.org. And it's got TIA is a different kind of financial partner. It's got nonprofit heritage, consistent performance, personal service for all. So I clicked on this, and it says, hey, you know, learn more. So I clicked on that, and it says, talk to a financial consultant, gives me a phone number, and says weekdays between 8 and 10 p.m. This doesn't sound like a huge mobile revolution in access to financial services for me. Maybe I'm reading this wrong.
No, it's okay. I think it's the, you know, it's the first step, right? In the world where you teach an elephant to dance, you teach him how to take the first step, and even acknowledge that there's a dance floor. Let's not forget, Brett, you know, who we are. We've got, a good chunk of our base doesn't even have a web ID, much less a mobile app. And we're really trying to move folks into a more engaged model. Frankly, just look at your money, pay attention, and let's start to talk about how you can do better. So that's our prime directive here, is to get people engaged. that starts at a more simple level than you might think of, you know, from a move-in perspective, right, where you've got the highly engaged 24/7 banking Gen Y customer. It's a different customer base with a different objective, and we're inching our way towards that. Two, right, you know, we've got a new design and a new foundation, a lot of new infrastructure that then allows us to build on things like, you know, secure chat, or 24/7 social media customer service, or some of these other things that we are absolutely thinking about, but we had to take the first step and move the infrastructure forward.
Right. Well, you know, so you talk about teaching an elephant to dance. It sounds like there's still a lot of teaching going on.
It's not so much there's a lot of teaching. Elephants don't run real fast. And you know, not for nothing, we started the project probably about 15 months ago, went out, did some really deep customer research. I've done probably 120 co-creation projects with our customers, both in the mobile and the desktop universe, by the way. We've tested every word on the site.
It's really open to everybody. You don't have to be a teacher to work with TIA, right?
No, you most certainly don't. Obviously, we focus on folks who are start really with retirement plans for not-for-profit institutions. But we have a bank and lots of other different product lines that anybody who was interested could access.
So, you know, on that point that I made, do you have to talk to an advisor to be able to sign up with you guys at the moment? Or?
No, you sure don't. I'd have to see exactly what you clicked on. But one of the key differences that we've got in the marketplace, Brett, is we do believe that everybody should have access to advice and guidance.
Browser handy?
We make that very prominent.
So have you got a browser handy?
I do.
So you go to TIAA.org, right, and the site comes up, and there's a big box, personal service for all. Right, and I clicked on that, and then I clicked on the next box, Learn More, and that's where it tells me to call a financial consultant. I would have liked me to, you know, like I didn't even know what financial services they are that you're selling at this point. So I think maybe there's a little bit of more work required in terms of engagement on that front.
Well, let's go. I'll challenge you right back. Right, one, my primary audience is the existing customer set. Who probably doesn't even know that they've got that option set. Two, really what you see is something we call the hero design and the mosaic design. Up in that top component, we're starting with what we think, based on our research, the most important thing for the participants to see, which is a quick description of where they are and the most prominent form of interaction with us, which is pick up the phone if you want advice. As you scroll down that page, now you get answers to your questions. What do we offer? And you can see nice, simple, plain language explaining what we offer. You see how you might get a one-on-one financial consultation and so on and so forth.
I don't see the detail, but I didn't get that. You know, maybe some work on, you know, when you first look at that page, maybe it could be read more or more of an indication. I could scroll down, but anyway, that's fine.
It's a great point. You know, and good example of some of the testing and learning. We actually had an original design, a sticky nav, you know, a black bar there with a table of contents that would lock at the top as we scrolled up. For a variety of reasons, we pulled it out. We discovered in testing that this exact problem popped up. We decided to launch without it because we needed a couple more months to get it, but not all that long from now, we'll have a new design in there, a little bit more agile, and that will address this exact issue.
Yeah, fair enough. So what did millennials think about all of this, about retirement? You know, because are millennials even thinking about retirement yet?
No, and that's, you know, part of we really do this for two reasons. One, we've got a population thinking about it, but needs, you know, some help engaging. And the truth is the new design actually, they're more surprised and excited by the new design system than the millennials are. And it's not that the millennials don't like it. They just expect everybody should have this. The millennials is a different challenge, which is they're still dealing with student debt. I don't have to tell you about the student debt crisis in this country. And we're really trying to help educate them for how to think about retirement within the context of their financial situation. So it's the beginning of engagement. We've got a big Gen Y initiative. We're working on some Gen Y community things, and so there'll be a lot more activity that we'll do there in the next couple of months to try to get Gen Ys, meet them where they are, and then drive them into some of the good content and services we've got here.
Fair enough. Well, you know, I mean, millennials think like that because I guess, you know, they're Well, you know, I think if you can serve millennials, you can serve anyone. You know, we're tending to, you know, there's a lot of digital immigrants these days that tend to behave more and more like digital natives as time goes on, and the rest are in a shrinking demographic. So if you're not serving millennials, I think you've got about 5 years and you run out of revenue, right? So
Again, I think when you're talking about retirement and wealth management, the numbers are slightly different, but your point remains, right? By 2020, they're 50% of the workforce. They're a supremely important demographic for us. We spend a lot of time really thinking about how to address their specific needs. You know, one of the things that's in the site, this
you,
is true
mobile right, or otherwise. You and I, Jamie, you and I are digital natives, right? I would say.
Yeah. We're probably at the cutting edge of it.
Right. You know, so some would say maybe we're digital immigrants, but we're really digital natives, I think, but we're not millennials. Right, so, yeah. Hey, listen. This is cool. So, I think we've said the website domain repeated times, but do you guys have an app you're launching?
So we already have a few apps. We've made some tweaks, but we're now cascading this thing right through the ecosystem. I think again, back in the elephants can dance. You gotta do a lot of research, set the foundation, and then extend. So we are. So right now, the teams are working on taking all the learnings in the design, extending them into the mobile apps. I'll go back to, you know, we're a retirement services provider first, expanding into those other services. The use case for mobile is just a little bit different. It's not a daily interaction set. So we're really tuning to how is it that people typically interact with us and, you know, addressing the screens appropriately based on those prime interaction modes.
Can someone sign up for a retirement plan on the app today?
No, they cannot enroll on the app today. That is absolutely something folks are taking a look at.
Okay, so I'll tell you what. Why don't you stick around after the break? We've got Clink joining us, which is an app that does that. So let's have a quick break, and then maybe if you've got some questions for Clink, I think Eli's joining us from Clink to sort of talk about that. So, but let's have a quick break. Just before I do go to break, thanks again for Temenos' sponsorship. Check them out at temenos.com. We'll be right back after this break. Hey all, this is Brett King, the host of Breaking Banks. We've got some exciting news for you. We've just joined with Radio Everyone and the United Nations on their Global Goals Initiative. Now, this is a 15-year plan to address 17 specific goals to end poverty, fight inequality, and fix climate change. So, Breaking Banks, we're planning a special episode on October the 1st to talk about the organizations around the world that are using fintech to increase financial inclusion, to eradicate poverty and reduce inequality. Join us at Breaking Banks and the team at Radio Everyone on the UN Global Goals Initiative to end poverty, fight inequality, and fix climate change.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, welcome back. I'm your host, Brett King. Derek Corcoran, who was on the show last week, just tweeted out, and he called me on this. He said, Moovin now offers a web sign-up as well as the in-app. We were formerly app-only sign-up. So, first of all, I think, you know, sign-up, should you be able to sign up online versus a browser? You know, we're agnostic to that. Someone wants to sign up online and then download the app, or sign up in the app and just go straight from there. We're cool with that. I think we, you know, that's why we've added support. And actually, the online stuff has been good, but we are still mobile first, dominantly mobile first. So, Derek, thanks for calling me out on that. But I wanted to talk about savings for millennials, sort of retirement for millennials, and dealing with this. And so there's an app that's just, well, it's been launched recently called Clink. C-L-I-N-K, and Eyal Fruchtman, who's the CEO of Clink, is joining us now. Eyal?
Yeah, hi, Brett. Thanks for having me.
Did I get that pronunciation right?
Yeah, you did.
Wow. Well, good. So so tell us about Clink and who you focused on and what's different about Clink.
Well, like you say, Clink is a saving and investing app. And what it does is it allows you to save a portion of your restaurant checks, basically. You set aside a certain percentage, let's say 10% out of every meal that you you dine out, and it earmarks those 10%, and it then accumulates a certain amount of dollars, and it moves that from your checking account to your Clink account, and it where it gets to invested in a diversified exchange-traded fund portfolio.
Okay. So now I tried to sign up earlier today. I downloaded the app. Now, you got the Facebook Connect, but that only just sort of pre-fills your name, so you've still got to go through a typical sign-up for a financial institution. But I got stuck when it asked for me to add my bank, because I tried to add Moovin and then CBW Bank, who's our partner bank, and I couldn't. So I wasn't able to actually play with the app for some investment today and try that. But you know, what's your typical user base look like, and what sort of investment or savings activity are they doing right now?
Well, our typical, what we found out, the typical user base is somebody who is in his 20s or 30s. You know, most of them save around $50 to $100 a month. And then we have a subset of those that actually move larger amounts, like in a lump sum of anywhere between $100 to $1,000.
Okay. And, you know, you can, this is at the moment, it's mobile only, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, we wanted to go out mobile first because we were, you know, we wanted to build something that is especially suited for millennials. And we found out that, you know, millennials, you know, they live around their cell phone. So we thought we would center everything around an app. Everything around a mobile environment.
So do you, you know, I don't know if you heard Jamie talking about TIAA's activities before the break, but do you buy this thesis that millennials aren't yet really investing strongly, or is your experience showing something differently?
Well, no, I agree with that. I think most millennials are not investing. Most millennials are kind of worried, you know, to invest or save. And this is one of the things that we thought we would try to sort of attack. And this is why we chose to associate investing with something fun like dining out, sort of to take away the stress of, you know, of having to choose stock or, you know, having to think about your money too much and just associate it with something fun.
Okay, fair enough. So how long have you guys been live?
Well, we just recently launched, so we've been live for about a month. But we had, you know, we have over 5,000 downloads, and you know, it's still going strong. So we were very optimistic.
Very good. And what sort of investment assets do you have underlying, or what sort of, you know, funds and so forth that sort of underlying the investments you guys offer?
So we basically have a portfolio that is based on a modern portfolio theory, which is to have a very diversified ETF balance of stocks and bonds, and it's distributed between anywhere from the S&P 500 to corporate bonds to emerging markets or European developed stocks.
Okay, so Jamie, what are your thoughts about what Clink's doing? And would you guys aspire to be? Would you aspire for TIA to be more like Clink?
So anything we can do to help millennials engage around retirement and savings in general is a good thing. So I applaud the effort just right out the gate. We talked about it, Brett. Engaging millennials, 50% of the workforce have to do it. It's part of the reason that we are expanding into banking services, because we have to engage people at that level. And absolutely, we are very much scanning the marketplace and looking for the right way for us to help millennials save more. And of course, mobile will be a big part of that.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Well, thanks, Brad. Thanks for having me.
All right, so if you're interested, check out Clink and on the App Store, and they're clink_.com is the Twitter ID. So if you want to engage or you get any questions for them, ping them on Twitter. Thanks very much. Okay, so David Milligan is also joining us today. David, sorry we took a while to get to you.
No problem, Brett. I'm glad to be here.
So David, you're the CEO of Matchy, and before we were talking about on the show before, we actually we had a show broadcast from your offices in Johannesburg a while back, where Schlebusch was on the show, which thank you for that. But so tell me about Matchy. You guys are sort of this glue, sort of a matching service, a dating service between fintech buyers and the innovators of the world, the startups and so forth. So tell me a little bit more about Matchy. What are you guys doing?
Sure thing. So, like you said, we are innovation matchmakers. We exist to connect financial institutions, and that means banks and insurance companies, around the world with leading fintech firms globally. So, our purpose really is to promote the diffusion of high-quality fintech innovation around the world. We started the company about 2.5 years ago. My co-founder, Warren Bond, is a seasoned fintech entrepreneur. I have a background in innovation in banking. I headed up innovation at Big Bang for about 10 years. And really, we started the firm a couple of years back recognizing that there had been some pretty fundamental shifts in the world. Certainly, financial institutions were more open than they'd ever been before to outside solutions. They're all grappling with the advent of fintech. And fintech, as an incredible category in the sense that it's a bunch, really thousands of firms around the world who bring together people who typically understand like a particular problem faced by a particular group of customers, and they have applied technology in smart ways to solve that problem.
On both sides of the coin, tell me about some of the companies you're working with and some of the organizations, the traditional financial service organizations that are coming to you to approach these innovators.
Sure. So we have a network of a little bit under 100 financial institutions around the world, from really big institutions like Bank Hapoalim, the biggest bank in Israel, is a sponsor, CaixaBank in Spain, Standard Bank in South Africa, and many other institutions in the US, in the UK, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, most interestingly, even some banks in Japan recently. And really the way we work is that we try to understand the focus areas of our financial institutions, and we provide them with targeted, high-quality fintech solutions that address those. So really, our belief is that financial institutions around the world face similar problems. And typically, they're quite aware of the solutions that are available in their home markets, but they're less aware of what's available around the world. And there's great stuff out there. And I mean, just listening to your previous conversation, typically, we would look to connect firms like Clink, perhaps a bit further down the line, with organizations like TIAA.
Right.
But if we can find, you know, a fantastic fintech firm in Israel and bring that in and connect it with a bank in the U.S., and really just help the financial institution bring things to market more quickly and respond to the needs of their consumers. And we can help the fintech firms to work with the right people in institutions, people who've got the mandate and the budget to actually innovate.
So apart from listening to Breaking Banks on a weekly basis, how do you guys find out about all this innovation that's taking place around the world?
We have people around the world in different markets who work with us. We travel an awful lot. We're at many of the fintech events, and we just really have this incredible community of fintech innovators that refer people to us. And a key thing that we do is we run innovation challenges. So our member banks will approach us to... they say they're looking for a particular set of problems to particular solutions, and we invite fintech firms around the world to enter their solutions, and then we facilitate a whole judging process with the financial institution that ultimately ends up with proof of concept projects for the innovators. So we just finished one for Sony. Sony has a bank, for those of you who didn't know, and we found some incredible solutions for them.
Great. So what have you got coming up, and how do people get to meet you and find out more about Matchy?
Sure. I think certainly they can follow us on Twitter, so that's MatchyBiz. They can look at our website, matchy.biz, B-I-Z. Really just follow us on social media, and you'll find us at many of the fintech events around the world speaking and participating.
Great. Well, thanks, David. We've tweeted out your the connection to the site, and your Twitter name. So check it out. And you know what? You and I should have a talk about working with getting moving into the Matchy system, because I think there'll be some options there.
Yeah, that'd be a great idea. I think the world is shifting towards cooperation. You know, it's very much for the last couple of years, it's moved away from this idea of fintechs wanting to eat the bank's lunch, and much more aimed at how do they cooperate, because they recognize that financial institutions have the reach and the customers, and they have great solutions. It's a win-win.
David Milligan, CEO of Matchy, thanks for joining us. Jamie Punishall, Head of Digital Marketing for TIA, also thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Brett.
Thanks again to our sponsor, Temenos. If you're interested, look forward to seeing you in Miami March the 10th. I'll be there. And also go sign up for the Innovation Jam at Temenos' Miami event. And for JP Nichols, he's going to be in Singapore for Breaking Banks coming up for an event there too. Check it out on breakingbanks.com or at temenos.com. Thanks for joining us again this week, guys. We will talk to you next week on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.